All rise. United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Well, good afternoon. I am Chief Judge Allen, and joining me on the bench is Judge Jaquith. Our colleague, Judge Falvey, is appearing by video. He was not able to be physically present here today. Before we go on, I just want to thank the student, staff, and faculty here at Suffolk University School of Law in Boston for the hospitality. The court hears oral arguments around the country from various times. And it's a great thing for the court, and we appreciate the hospitality. So we're here this afternoon to consider arguments in the consolidated cases of Eric D. Billhartz, case number 22-6158, and Anthony J. Pinto, Jr., case number 23-7931, both versus Douglas A. Collins, the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Would counsel, beginning with the appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record?
Good afternoon. My name is James Ridgway. With me at counsel table is Tom Posano. We represent the veteran Eric Billhartz, and we are also appearing as amicus for Mr. Anthony J. Pinto. And I'll just note for our audience who may not understand, this means for Mr. Pinto, we have access only to the documents on the public docket and not his full record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ridgway. Secretary's counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ronan Morris for the secretary, and with me is Megan Crowell.
Nice to see you both again. Just for those who are here, I want to commend the Secretary's two counsel. They also appeared in our last travel oral argument in a much warmer climate in Gulfport, Florida, only about a month and a half ago. So thank you very much. Mr. Ridgway, I understand you're going to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, you can begin when you're ready.
May it please the court, Mr. Billhartz's appeal should be remanded for a new decision by the judge who heard his testimony, and Mr. Pinto's appeal should be remanded for an opportunity for a new hearing followed by a decision by the judge who heard his testimony. I want to make three specific points today. First, I want to address a specific harm caused by reassignment of an appeal. Second, I want to explain how this violates fair process and due process. And finally, I want to go over why Bryant requires that a VLJ must ask all questions reasonably necessary to sympathetically develop a claim to its optimum before deciding it on the merits.
Mr. Ridgway, before you go on, right, because now we've got your roadmap, right? So I want to just ask you a bigger picture question, right? So as you know, in the early years of the court developed the fair process doctrine. At the same time, we know in law school, we learn in constitutional law, there's something called the due process clause and Matthews versus Eldridge. In your view, is there anything that would violate the fair process doctrine that would not violate the due process doctrine? In other words, is there any space between them? Do you follow me?
Yes, absolutely. And the answer is fair process is different from due process. Due process developed primarily for adversarial systems where the adjudicator may be passive and neutral. This is not a system with that kind of adjudicator. Fair process holds VA to the standard set forth by Congress to sympathetically develop claims to its optimum before deciding it on the merits.
So then there would be things, in your view, that would not be mandated by a statute or regulation, not prohibited or required by the Due Process Clause of the Constitution, but yet we would be able to say this procedure must take place.
Absolutely.
So what do we do then with the Federal Circuit's statement in Francis, where the court says there is uncertainty surrounding the doctrine, talking about the fair process doctrine, and how it is applied. And then the court said the fair process doctrine is a recognition that due process applies in the claimant process. And so what I'm wondering is, what does that sentence do to our precedent about fair process? Because the Federal Circuit seems to be saying it's six of one, half dozen of another, and it's not saying it's different.
Yeah, and it does nothing because that was not an issue that the Federal Circuit decided. The Federal Circuit agreed with this court that fair process had not been adequately briefed and argued in the original Francis case, and was, I listened to the argument, and the chief judge did comment that that was her view, and counsel at that time was unable to rebut it, but the Federal Circuit has never been presented with the argument that I am making now. And to be clear, they were not being presented with any argument at fair process in Francis. They declined to address fair process. This court and that court addressed only the interpretation of the statute. Now that issue is fully developed and presented, and this court can explain that fair process is different. It is the court's ability to use its authority under 38 U.S.C. 7261A3A to hold unlawful VA's abuses of discretion. Now,
could I just stop you, and then I promise I'll let you get out. I'll get out of your way. But so, most of the time, what we say, Judge Toth recently wrote an opinion in which he talked about fair process, and I'm blanking on the name of it right now. But, you know, what he underscored in that opinion for the court was that fair process couldn't be used to overcome an express statutory provision. And I'm assuming you would agree with that.
I believe so, but that's not the issue here.
No, okay, well, fair enough. What do we do here with the fact that this isn't just a question of the statute being silent about this question? Because in Francis, we held and the Federal Circuit affirmed that Congress expressly removed this requirement. So if we were to say that the Constitution doesn't require the same adjudicator to decide the case as considered the hearing, what would be the basis of our authority to then tell Congress, but yet we're going to say, even though the Constitution doesn't require it, that we're going to say it does, even though in this case it's not just that the statute is silent, it's that Congress actually took it out affirmatively?
I think we have to be clear about what Francis did and what Francis held. Francis commented that there is no legislative history explaining why this was removed. It applied a textual presumption that the language disappearing was intentional. And that is the same textual presumption that the Federal Circuit applied to say that the statute must have changed meaning.
But isn't the best way, I mean, and of course you're in a difficult position because, as you know, but everybody in the gallery might not, you just happen to draw the exact same panel as in Francis. Isn't the best indicator of what Congress meant to do what Congress actually did?
So I think that there is a fundamental difference between Congress doing something that requires a textual presumption to understand versus Congress explicitly saying, we're doing this on purpose. As this court did in Morton, when it held that the duty to assist does not apply to a claim that is not well-grounded, it went on to comment saying, Congress, we don't think you meant to write it this way. We don't think you were thinking about this. We invite you to come in and clarify. And that's what happened. Congress came in and with the VCAA and then rewrote the duty to assist to address that oversight, which I believe is what this court called it. And this court cited other instances where courts have thought that something happened may not have been intentional. Now, when we look at the legislative history, no one commented on this. The acting chairman of the board testified in favor of the Appeals Modernization Act. And that person with the highest stake in this particular change, assuming it was intentional, said nothing. He gave no explanation that would say that this was more than a drafting error, which this court is compelled under a textual statute to give meaning to. But that, if we're thinking about separation of powers, there is a very real difference between the separation of powers concern when Congress clearly articulates this is what we want, and when Congress does something else, and then afterwards you say, oh, there's this other thing that's in the language that appears to allow for something that no one ever talked about in this process, not even the body that was most directly affected by it.
Isn't that, though, a dangerous road to go down for a court to then say, even though what Congress did, what it did, was clear, right? And you have to accept it that both us and the Federal Circuit said that's what happened. But that we're going to somehow undermine what they're doing because they didn't explain to us in legislative history why they did it?
Well, Congress has been equally clear in two directions. So in enacting the Veterans Judicial Review Act, Congress wrote that it had designed a system and fully intends to maintain a beneficial, non-adversarial system of veteran benefits. Congress expects VA to fully and sympathetically develop the veteran's claim to its optimum before deciding it on the merits. Nothing in the history of the AMA suggests that Congress's clear statement about the type of system that it wanted when it created judicial review was something it was backtracking on. So this isn't a matter of Congress has only said one thing. Congress has very clearly said one thing, and then addressing a different issue has said something that might be implied to walk back their statement that this is a sympathetic system there where claims are fully developed to their optimum. Faced with two contrary statements by Congress, I think it's entirely fair for this court, as part of the dialogue between the branches, to say, we think that Congress probably meant to preserve the character. And as in Morton, if we're wrong, make the statute more clear, and we will do what you say.
Assume that I, just one judge, just I don't buy that because, you know, I felt like we considered that in Francis, right? But so tell me why the requirement or the lack of a requirement to have the same adjudicator would violate, for my purposes now, due process.
Sure. Let me begin by going back to the first point I was going to make, which was focusing on what is the harm, because I want to make sure that's clear on the table before I explain why that violates due process. So the Secretary has not disputed any of the harms that we've put forth in our briefs. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on credibility and weight determinations, because I think the case law covers that well. The specific harm I think is most important is moving the target after the dart has been thrown. That is fundamentally what happens when you reassign a case, and it is just as unfair as it sounds. Every judge is different. Every judge's approach to hearings is different, and they're going to tailor that hearing to their specific view of the law. I mean, just take, for example, this hearing. Judge Falvey was unable to appear in person. Why not simply select another judge from this court who could make it to hold the hearing and then let Judge Falvey read the transcript? Judge Falvey wants to participate even if he can only do so by Zoom because he wants to ask the questions that matter to him. And so Mr. Pinto's case is a clear example of why this matters. He was seeking a higher rating for his PTSD, and whether he's entitled to a 30% or 50% turns upon his level of occupational and social impairment. A 30% rating, which he received, is based upon occasional decrease in work efficiency and intermittent periods of inability to perform occupational tasks, whereas a 50% is provided if there is difficulty in establishing and maintaining effective work and social relationships. Where is the line between those two standards? What specific facts are going to persuade a judge that the veteran has established entitlement to a 50% rating? There are 125 different judges at the board, and there are 125 different ways that that line is drawn. Some are closer than others, but if we're going to sympathetically develop a claim to its optimum before deciding it on the merits, it must be the person who is going to make the decision that elicits the testimony as to that particular standard.
Now, why wouldn't it be enough to say that if the board member who was assigned to decide the case and assume it was somebody who was different than who conducted the hearing, why wouldn't it be enough to say if that board member didn't feel that the hearing provided sufficient information for him or her to decide the case, that would be the safeguard, that that second person would then say, I need more information to develop the claim to its optimum?
So the VA has not suggested in any way there is such a procedure like that could be invoked. I have never seen a judge ask for a second hearing.
Well, maybe not a second hearing, although I will ask Mr. Morris, so you know, get ready to answer. Maybe they just say, listen, I don't have enough information. And so that they then solicit information from the veteran or the secretary, depending on which side of the aisle the information would lie. I mean, wouldn't that deal with the issue that you're talking about, which is somebody doesn't solicit the information that would be needed to decide the claim?
Yeah, and I think what you're talking about is essentially grafting a Thurber-like fair process onto the hearing, where if you need something that's not in the record, you have to reach out to the veteran. And Thurber was like, I went to the shelf, I pulled off a medical treatise that's not in the record, and I'm giving you notice of what I'm considering. This would be very similar in terms of, I'm missing information, I need you to tell me before I get to it, but this veteran is involved, has notice, has an opportunity to respond.
So now you are, though, making what I'm going to call, it's my words, not the words they used in your briefing, but you're making a categorical argument, right, aren't you, that in all circumstances, the person who conducts the hearing has to be the same person who renders the decision on the claim?
Yes, we are making a categorical argument, and I'm not claiming that there are no circumstances in which such a violation could be found to be not prejudicial, perhaps if the issue were veteran status and there was simply no dispute about that. But it has to be a categorical rule, because once the VA has moved the target, there is no way to know if the judge who heard the hearing would have done something different. This is
So if we're leaving aside fair process, under the due process clause, one of the elements that we, it's not elements, factors that we consider under Matthews versus Eldridge is the sort of government interest, right?
Absolutely.
And so, you know, the last time I looked, and this was in connection with a writ petition that was filed, and I asked the secretary to respond, and basically he told me that there were 65,000 plus or minus hearing requests pending. It strikes me that the government could say it was going to be incredibly disruptive in terms of how these cases are decided and the timeline on which they're decided, if you have to match up those 65,000 to the people who decide. And you said that, what, there are 135 of them, and by the time we're done today, right, we could be down to 90. We don't know what happens in Washington, right? So isn't that an important feature?
And the answer is no. And let me walk through the due process analysis from the beginning to make that clear. First, we are talking about the removal of a traditional common law right, which under Honda v. Oberg means the burden is on the secretary to satisfy the Matthews test. It is not on the veteran. The burden is on the secretary, because we are taking away a traditional common law right to be heard by the person who is making the decision. Now, if the question is risk of erroneous deprivation, which is what due process cares about, then we know from the VA's own reports that in the legacy system, where reassignment was not allowed as a matter of course, a veteran who had a hearing had a 50% higher chance of having their claim granted on an apples-to-apples, issue-by-issue basis. And so we're talking about a process that increases the chance of a grant by 50% over what it would be without it. And therefore, the secretary has to demonstrate to you that that will not change in this system. And even if it could, the government's interest is not merely to win. As the Supreme Court recognized in Walters, the government's interest is maintaining the paternalistic, claimant-friendly, informal system that makes veterans feel like the government is on its side. And furthermore, reassignment of cases does not add any additional efficiencies. Veterans' cases must wait in docket order. When they get to the top of the docket order, they're allocated by the VA's computer system. If it's a case with a hearing and in the legacy system, it is automatically routed. The computers are programmed to do that. So the system is already built to handle cases in that way. Now, if an individual judge has a bubble of hearing cases come to the top of the docket at the same time, the simple solution is to just not assign them general population cases until they've worked through their hearing cases. Reassignment is fundamentally less efficient. It does not give the board more judges. It does not give the board judges more time in the day. It takes a case from a judge who has invested time in preparing and holding a hearing, who has become familiar with the case, and gives it to a judge who has to start over from square one with no knowledge. The government has not explained how that can make the system more efficient. At the very most, all it could do is take a veteran who might have to wait a little bit longer for the judge who held the hearing to be able to have a clear spot to make a decision, and for them to come up, even though their case was already up in the top of docket order. But there's been no showing as to how much lift is gained, and as a matter of logistics, the system is already built to distribute cases this way, and the VA, the board, has actually started turning that affinity back on for AMA cases. I've been to congressional roundtables where VA leadership has been, the board's leadership has been grilled about this, and they've indicated, yes, no, we understand that people are unhappy, and so we've turned this back on. And so it is not a heavy lift. And fundamentally, what it does is it gives the veteran the opportunity to be heard the way they want to be heard, as their own report said, to look the judge in the eye who's going to make the decision and tell them their story. And so with the 5 minutes that I have left, I did want to take some time to talk about the Bryant hearing issue, which is separate from the reassignment issue.
Before you do so,
1 second, I think Judge Falvey has a question. Judge Falvey?
Yep, can you hear me?
We can, I think.
Great. You're right, Mr. Ridgway. I do have a few questions. I'm sorry I can't be there to ask them to you in person. But before you move on from due process, you cite the Supreme Court's Raddatz decision, and that case held that it's acceptable to judge his decision on a suppression hearing without rehearing the witnesses. And then it held that allowing that doesn't violate due process. To get to that holding, the Supreme Court explained how in administrative law, it's not uncommon to have the final decision maker not be the hearing officer, and that they don't have to defer to the hearing officer's findings. So it seems like the Supreme Court has, in at least administrative law, it's fine to have a different person do your hearing than decide your case. So how do we get around that part of Raddatz? Help us to write something along the lines. True, the Supreme Court has said that in administrative law, due process allows for having a final decision maker different than the hearing officer. But in this case of administrative law, what?
So first, as to Raddatz itself, the Supreme Court, the issue before the court was, does the district court judge have to rehear the testimony to make an independent determination? And the Supreme Court said that is not allowed. But in footnote 7, it said, we assume it is unlikely that a district court judge would reject a magistrate judge's proposed findings on credibility when those are dispositive and substitute their own appraisal without seeing or hearing the witnesses whose credibility is in question, which could give way to serious questions which we do not reach. So that was about a case moving up to a higher level without an independent hearing, which takes me to my second point, which is it is not the case that in administrative systems, a board who does not hear the testimony is completely free to disregard the findings of the person who did. And so I would go back to Arneson, in particular to the Federal Circuit case that this court cited in Arneson, Leatherbury versus Department of Army, where the Federal Circuit basically, if you read that, it's talking about the MSPB, where the administrative judge may not be the one who hears the testimony, but it may ultimately be decided by the full board, which did not hear the testimony. And that case says that we recognize the MSPB does not have to agree with the administrative judge with one important exception. That's what the Federal Circuit says, with one important exception. The higher body cannot reject the credibility findings made by the administrative judge without citing substantial evidence in the record showing that the administrative judge's credibility determination was without merit and foundation in the record. And in that case, I would even note that when you read it, the administrative judge in that case did not make an explicit credibility finding. The finding was implicit, and the Federal Circuit noted by making findings that were consistent with what the petitioner in that case had said, the administrative judge was clearly accepting the credibility of that worker who had been fired. And in that, for that reason, the MSPB could not decide the case on a basis that took his testimony as not credible without providing substantial evidence in the record showing why the AJ made a mistake. And so
does that provide you any help here, where at least in Mr. Bilharz's case, it doesn't seem that credibility was in doubt or there was an adverse credibility determination? And in Mr. Pinto, I think it would be a stretch to say that there was a credibility issue presented in that case as well.
As we said in our opening brief and in our supplemental brief, credibility is only one subset of all the issues that arise with reassignment. Weight is the true spectrum of how a credibility or testimony is evaluated. And more importantly, you're moving the target after the veteran has already thrown the dart. And changing what it needs to be shown in order to grant the claim cannot possibly be appropriate.
You've said that twice, or three times. I don't understand why. I mean, wouldn't you have to point to something? So I agree with you. At the heart of due process, if you move the dartboard after I've thrown the dart, that's a violation of due process, right? You know, it's not taught that way in constitutional law, but that's good enough for us. But you have to show that somebody moved the dartboard. You can't just say, if you move the dartboard, this is going to happen, because I agree with you, right? But wouldn't that be the same regardless of whether the adjudicator changed? If the person holding the hearing set the dartboard in one location, and then when they decided the decision, moved the dartboard, that would be, in my view, that would be a due process problem, because you've moved the dartboard. But isn't the problem here that we don't have any evidence that the dartboard moved for either Mr. Bilharz or Mr. Pinto?
I mean, I think we can all take notice of our years of experience of practice in this area. Different judges at the board decide cases differently in patterns. Some judges are more willing to credit uncorroborated lay testimony than others. Some take a broader view of proximate cause for secondary service connection than others. Some.
Do we have anything in the record here on which we could base a determination that the dartboard in my hypothetical has been moved?
That's the fundamental problem why this has to be a categorical rule. We will never know what was in the head of the judge who is tailoring their questions to the hearing and the veteran in front of them. And because this is the type of error which cannot be reviewed on a case-by-case basis, because we don't know what the original judge was thinking, that this is clearly a problem. And I would note that, you know, in Honda, one of the things the Supreme Court commented on is that there is precious little case law when we're talking about the removal of a traditional common law right, because normally it's just never done.
There is no common law right here, right? Honda dealt with the Oregon statute involving review of punitive damages. At common law, there wasn't a right to receive veterans' benefits. There were hearings in common law,
yes.
but I mean, this is the reason that we can hear these cases is because precisely they are not common law cases.
Yeah. And what I would say to that is when we go back to Honda when we go back to Raddatz, I mean, they did not pull this statement about reassignment.
And just by the way, you've gone over time, but we've taken you over time. So I'm going to ask Dawn, our courtroom clerk, who I can barely see, to add 5 more minutes. So if you just so you know that.
So the Supreme Court cites to the English courts and the views of the Lord Coleridge of the Privy Council to say that the view of the English courts was that retrial based on a cold record cannot be allowed because it does not allow the person to give or look at the manner of the witness, his hesitations, his doubts, his variations, his language. We cited in our opening brief an 1860 report of the English courts of chancery after they had experimented with having evidence taken by one official and then given to another. And they declared it an evil of principle and not in the details and basically said, no, this will never work. So this is not something that was unknown to the English courts. I think the Supreme Court has made clear in Raddatz that they did look to traditional English law practice, and they found that it was against reassignment. And so finally, I did want to take a moment to address why the Bryant hearing duty requires a VLJ to ask all questions reasonably necessary to fully develop a claim to its optimum before deciding it on the merits. This means obtaining a complete history of the frequency, severity, and duration of symptoms and how they've changed over time if this was not already clear. First, step one, VA already conceded that Bryant applies to AMA hearings. And so they can't change their mind now from what they put in the notice of final rulemaking. But more importantly, then the question becomes, what is the standard for judging that a Bryant violation has happened? And there's three ways to look at it. You can start at the statute, which is what we did in our briefs, and say that 5103 big A, little a is the default standard when you're asking the question of whether or not VA has provided reasonable assistance. And this is a question of reasonable assistance.
Can that statute be the standard when the statute itself relieves the board of any duty to assist responsibility?
I think if this is a statute that was built up in layers over time. The 5103A, big A, was not part of the AMA. And when we look at Congress's intent to eliminate the churn, that was about eliminating remands for development. I don't think it can be overread to say that it took the board hearing from a sympathetic, paternalistic exercise where a judge sympathetically develops a claim to its optimum and turned it into a cold traditional adversarial system where the judge can sit there. And to quote, even if we don't buy the statutory argument, even if we don't buy it, let's look at how to interpret 20.705, the regulation that VA adopted, where the final rulemaking says these regulations do not intend to limit the holding of Bryant. The regulation will assist.
Excuse me. Mr. Ridgway, can you point us to any case law that stands for the proposition that Federal Register notice trumps the explicit language of the regulation?
So, first of all, the language of the regulation is not explicit. So, Step 20.705 says the duties of the presiding member include, but are not limited to. And so the statement in the Federal Register is not contrary. It is. Filling in a gap left by the statement, but are not limited to. And in filling that gap, just like in Menegassi, which we cite in our briefs, the Federal Circuit said, We know what this means. I believe that was 3.304F. We know what this applies to because you said it in the Federal Register, and we're going to hold you to your intent expressed in the Federal Register. And I believe there's other examples, although I don't have them in front of me. But fundamentally, that Register posting said, the hearing will be as assistive as possible to the veteran in substantiating the claim. And what does assistance mean? Well, the regulation incorporates by reference, again, 5103 big A, little a, which defines the general way in which VA's duty to assist is evaluated. And then even if you said there was no on statute on point, there's no regulation on point, then we're back in the world of fair process, under the fair process, Bryant, not the due process, Bryant, where there's a gap left by statute and regulation, and the backfill for that gap, as recognized in Arneson, Bryant, Smith, they all cite to Hodge. They all cite to congressional intent on how to police VA's use of its discretion, and it's to make sure that VA continues to sympathetically develop claims to their optimum before deciding them on the merits. That is what reasonable assistance provides, and regardless of which of the three paths you take, it ends up in the same place.
Judge Falvey, do you have anything else right now for Mr. Ridgway?
I do not.
Jake. And we'll restore your full rebuttal time, Mr. Ridgway.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Morris? And as you're walking to the podium, you are you can have an extra 5 minutes if you need it, because I gave it to Mr. Ridgway, but you are never penalized for not taking all your time. So there we go.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Your Honors, if I may briefly, I have 3 points. First, Your Honors, there is no actual or empirical evidence that allowing a different VLJ to decide an appeal impacts the outcome of the appeal, let alone that it increases the risk of an erroneous deprivation of benefits. Two, even assuming that such risk exists, VA's system is replete with safeguards that adequately protect against that risk. And three, Your Honors, fair process does not permit this court to circumvent clear congressional intent by inserting a procedural requirement into the AMA that Congress deliberately removed. The very essence of the separation of powers is that it is not the role of the court to decide what policies or procedures might be better or wiser than the ones chosen by Congress or the Secretary. At the end of the day, the VA system provides claimants with a fundamentally fair and a meaningful opportunity to present their case and to rebut any adverse determinations, and neither due process nor fair process, to the extent it survives, requires anything more.
Your Honor, do you think, if anything, the Federal Circuit did when it made its comments about the fair process doctrine in Francis? In other words, do you see a daylight between due process and fair process, such that something could not violate due process, but yet violate fair process?
No, Your Honor. Well, I don't know that it's necessary to resolve that question. No, there is no daylight. Fair process was created before due process applied in the claims context. And as the Federal Circuit recognized, it was that recognition of, you know, due process rights in that context. Due process now does apply. The idea of reading a non-constitutionally mandated procedural requirement into the silence in a statute or regulation would be entirely inconsistent with the idea of not reading words into statutes or regulations that are not there. And in this case, Your Honors, it would also, again, require the court to ignore the the intent of Congress and the Secretary, who both made policy choices regarding whether to require the same VLJ to decide appeals. And again, that ultimately would be a violation of the separation of powers for this court to rely on a doctrine that essentially would allow it to circumvent or overrule the policy choices made by Congress or the Secretary.
What about the substantial number of cases since Cushman made clear that due process applies that have strengthened, reemphasized, highlighted fair process rights and obligations?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it's appropriate for the court to simply rely on its own case law without considering the boundaries of its own authority. And simply relying on case law to increase the court's authority or to augment the court's authority would be inappropriate. Those cases thus should be read in the same context of merely recognizing due process rights, but under an analysis for a fair process. But ultimately, the fair process analysis is subsumed essentially by a due process analysis.
But the cases themselves make clear that that's not so, that they view that those precedential case majorities viewed fair process as being coextensive with due process.
To the extent that it's coextensive, to the extent that it exists as an independent analysis, the results cannot provide greater rights or greater process than what due process would require. Because again, expanding the doctrine beyond what the Constitution requires, it would require some source of authority. And that's either the Constitution or that's a statute. And again, when interpreting statutes, courts do not read words into statutes that are not there, and courts should not circumvent the clear intent of either Congress or, in the case of a regulation, the executive. And to the extent that fair process would allow the court to do so, it would violate the separation of powers. To the extent that fair process has not been relied on that to this point, then there's nothing incompatible with it due process and the court's authority.
That would be true if the court endorsed the fair process doctrine in contravention of a specific statutory determination, but that's not what the cases have held. They're talking about the space between things that are expressly provided and those that are not.
And I'd suggest, Your Honor, to the extent that those cases effectively drew what was Congress's intent or what was the Secretary's intent, then it's not inconsistent with the requirements or the canons of construction of statutes and regulations. But again, using fair process to circumvent the rules of statutory and regulatory interpretation or to impose requirements that are not constitutionally mandated is simply inconsistent with the separation of powers. And what we have here, Your Honor, is quintessentially purely a policy choice. There was a requirement in the statute that the same VLJ who conducts the hearing participates in the making of the decision, and Congress deliberately removed that requirement. The Secretary amended the Secretary's regulations and also deliberately removed that requirement. It was policy choices made by Congress, and it was policy choices made by the Secretary.
But in both cases, statutorily and regulatory, it says nothing. Neither the statute nor VA's regulations say anything about the topic.
Precisely because they removed, both of them removed the very requirement. And the Federal Circuit in Francis recognized that this was a deliberate removal by Congress of the requirement, and the Secretary's amendments to his regulations reflect the exact same. The Secretary moved the requirement that previously existed under the statute into a regulation and specified that it applied only to legacy claims. The Secretary proposed a new rule and removed that specific sentence requiring the participation of the judge who conducts the hearing and the making of the decision. It could not be any clearer than that. And as the Federal Circuit recognized in Francis, the language and the history of 7107, the AMA is clear at this point.
What about the interpretive canon that holds that Congress acts with knowledge of whatever court it is, our court's case law? So that it's just as likely that by clearing the landscape, they left it to a fair process determination, categorical or as applied.
It's hard to imagine that Congress took deliberative action to remove a requirement under the assumption that the court would nevertheless reimpose that very same requirement. It is clear that Congress removed the requirement, gave the discretion to the Secretary. The Secretary also, as a matter of policy choice, decided to remove the requirement as well. And again, those are policy
decisions. Well, the last part's definitely not clear. It's clear that Congress removed the requirement, but there was nothing in the removal of the requirement that said anything about anybody's discretion.
Well, Congress removed the requirement, meaning that the secretary was not required, or the board was not required by statute to require the same board judge who conducts the hearing to also decide the appeal. The secretary, again, promulgated a regulation that removed that very same requirement. So presumably the secretary could have, as a policy matter, decided to re-implement it, but the secretary did not. And again, that's a policy decision, and there are many reasons that would support those policy decisions, and those were decisions made by the secretary based on the secretary's knowledge of the system.
And so you'd, or would you agree so the appellant, as you said, and I asked Mr. Ridgway, is advocating for a categorical rule saying that there must always be the same person, subject to perhaps a harmless error analysis. I'm assuming the secretary agrees that there could be situations in which something could happen at the hearing compared to what is in the decision that would, to go back to the dartboard hypothetical, would have moved the dartboard in some way. In other words, there could be not a situation that it is always a violation of due process, but it could sometimes be. You'd agree that that could happen, right?
Hypothetically, yes.
Yeah, right. So for example, although I admit I have struggled to find an example that requires there to be two different people, but hypothetically, let's just assume at the hearing, the person who conducts the hearing says to the veteran, I believe you 100%. You are the most credible witness I have ever had about the experience of your pain. And then when it comes to the decision, no matter who wrote the decision says, I rule against you because I find that your statements about the continuity of your pain are not credible. There'd be at least a pretty potentially significant issue there because the person really wouldn't have had a meaningful opportunity, because why put in any more information about his pain because you've been told you're the most credible person ever, right? Something like that.
That would likely touch on at least due process rights in that particular case. But I would also note that we, in assessment of that, need not even necessarily get to due process or fair process, because there are other safeguards and other checks in place. It would seem to me pretty difficult for the board in issuing its decision to provide a plausible basis for justifying that later determination given what was said earlier. And so again, the system itself has checks on even that extreme example.
But the point, I just want to pin you down. I want to pin the secretary down metaphorically on this point, which is that you are not saying that this has to be a categorical, you could never get to the Constitution. There could be a hypothetical in which there would be a constitutional violation.
In an individual as applied case, yes, Your Honor, there certainly could. I can't imagine what that necessarily would be, again, given the safeguards, but it's not the secretary's position that the secretary is unable to violate.
Right. And basically your safeguard position would be that if we were hypothetically faced with you're the most credible person ever, and then you're not credible, there would be non-constitutional bases that we could rely on. And on the doctrine of constitutional avoidance, we would do that and not necessarily have to get to due process, even if due process itself would provide the remedy.
That's correct, okay. Your Honor. And going to the origin of that point, though, even these alleged harms asserted by at least Mr. Bilhard, they're conjecture. They are purely hypothetical to begin with. There's no data that supports, again, that there's any relationship between the use of a second, different VLJ and the outcome of a case. And again, there's nothing that ties that to an increased risk of an erroneous denial of benefits. And to be clear, that's the standard under due process, is the risk of an erroneous deprivation of the protected interest, in this case, the entitlement to benefits. due process does not protect a veteran's right in a favorable outcome of a case.
Would you address either now or sometime before you sit down the argument from appellant that you, as the secretary, have the burden to show that this is not a violation?
We absolutely do not, Your Honor.
I figured you'd say that, and then the follow-up sentence is.
Your Honor, we do not, and for several reasons. I mean, one, the appellant's reliance on Honda Motor Company is entirely misplaced here. There is no well-established common law protection of, you know, within the context of veterans' benefits, a purely statutory benefits within the administrative system in which those are provided that gives claimants a common law right to a hearing. In fact, even Honda Motor Company itself and the Supreme Court recognized that that's, even if it is well-established common law protection, it's still not dispositive of the outcome. But perhaps more relevant is after that decision, the Supreme Court decided the Raddatz case, which recognized that this is actually not an uncommon feature in administrative systems. And again, it confirmed that there is no constitutional due process right to have a hearing. In that case, it involved a trial court and a magistrate, but that there is no constitutional right to have the same person hear the testimony and make the decision, at least in that, provided that there's no adverse credibility determination made after a favorable one, which is certainly not a risk here. But Your Honor, beyond that, even after the Raddatz case was the Walters case, in which the Supreme Court recognized that in light of the informal proclaimant nature of the VA systems, the due process does not require the same kinds of procedures that would be required in, conventional adversarial proceedings. So again, even subsequently, the Supreme Court's recognized that the VA system, because of the way that it's built, doesn't require the same due process protections that are required in other systems. And if I can take a step back further, Your Honor, the appellant's argument here has suggested that the totality of rights that a claimant has is at the board. But claims aren't filed with the board. Claims are filed at the agency, and the position overlooks the entire part of the administrative process, including the right to be heard at the AOJ, which in fact is in front of the same adjudicator who will decide the claim. And the AOJ is the entity that decides dispositively the overwhelming majority of cases, and it is the primary adjudicator. The board is an appellate body.
And so just for everybody here who doesn't speak lingo, right, the AOJ is the agency of original jurisdiction, right, which is basically where it starts at the VA?
Yes, essentially the regional office. The board is an appellate body.
But still, isn't the board VA's ultimate fact finder?
It is in the sense that it is the highest tribunal, but even that is somewhat questionable under the AMA because the administrative appeal system under the AMA allows continuous administrative review effectively in perpetuity even after board decisions. So the ultimate fact finder may very well, again, even after a board decision, be the AOJ, the regional office, after an adverse board decision if they grant the claim. So, Your Honor, it's not as simple. And for that reason, the appellant's reliance on those earlier cases, including Arneson, those were all decided in a very different context, in the context of a requirement that the same VLJ conduct a hearing and decide the appeal. And in those cases, based on that requirement, it was possible for credibility determinations to be made on things such as demeanor and body language. That's not possible.
Except
anymore.
Arneson said that the switch in board members violates the veteran's right to notice and a meaningful opportunity to be heard.
Because
or due process requirements that apply across the board in our system.
Due process derives ultimately, for you have to look at the entire structure. And the structure at that time, the statutory structure, required the same VLJ who holds the hearing to participate in the making of the decision, meaning that under that structure, the VLJ deciding the case very well could make a credibility determination based on, again, things such as demeanor. That's no longer the case. That was a policy choice. It is simply not the case where the VLJ deciding, assuming that they're different, can make an adverse credibility determination or a favorable credibility determination based on something that they did not observe and that there's no indication of. The appeal has to be decided based on the record. That includes the transcript, but it does. But that's it. And so that's simply, it's just one aspect of the determination that was removed. And so those cases which highlighted the importance of having the same member, the importance of the live testimony, this is under a different system. And in fact, this is under an incredibly fundamentally different system, the AMA. Again, where the board is not necessarily the final final decision maker, because again, there is ongoing ability to review. And claimants have...
The board is still the final within the agency decision maker.
Final in the sense of highest, yes, but the AMA permits ongoing administrative review. So a claimant can still get an adjudication by the regional office, by the AOJ, even after an adverse board decision. So final, yes, in the sense of this is the highest body speaking on behalf of the secretary. Final in the sense of, you know, timeline, not necessarily. And again, the board's the board hearing, again, is one aspect of a greater system, a system that begins at the AOJ, the AOJ being the body that under the AMA Congress charged with developing the claims. And so the idea that the board is required to take these development practices is simply misplaced. Congress made a choice, again, another policy decision when it enacted the AMA. It pushed development to the AOJ. The board, again, serves primarily as an appellate body. It can identify development issues, you know, or errors by the AOJ, but it's not responsible for developing the evidence itself, which again limits the importance or the significance of the board hearing, what it might have been once, when after a board decision, the veteran's only recourse was to appeal to this court. That significance is lessened at this point, and there are safeguards.
Yeah, well, the secretary's initial briefing in Bilhar's cited Bryant as one of those safeguards in place to avoid the potential harm of having one VLJ conduct the hearing and a different VLJ with a different approach decide the case. And then the secretary's supplemental briefing argued that Bryant doesn't apply to board hearings under the AMA. So which is it?
It is the latter response, Your Honor. I did not write the brief in the Bilhar's case, but it did not appear to have been a contested issue. I think it was simply just assumed that, you know, the Bryant requirements were satisfied in that case and at that point. But on the specific question of whether it's required to be to apply, it's probably a better way of phrasing it. The answer is no, because
could I ask you to answer two questions about the Bryant thing, which I have found difficult before the argument today. The other one that Mr. Ridgway mentioned that I had not thought of. So the first one is, what do we do with a situation, and you don't have to accept what I'm saying, where the regulation, it says one thing pretty clearly, right? A hearing before notice is issued under whatever, right? Which by definition would not include a board decision, board hearing. But then at the same time, the regulatory history says that the secretary says we're not getting rid of Bryant, right? And then related to that, Mr. Ridgway's point that perhaps the adoption of the regulation that does apply to the board now under the AMA
isn't written in an exhaustive way and leaves some gap to be filled. And so we should read into there that the secretary meant to apply these Bryant duties. Do you understand those two?
Yes.
Okay.
Whether I remember them, different. But as to the first question, Your Honor, statements of policy made in the Federal Register are irrelevant in the face of the plain language of the regulation. And, you know, the canons of construction clearly support that. We don't need to get into the legislative or to the regulatory history when a regulation is plain. And in this case, it is. There is clearly no requirement. That change also, that commentary was also made in the context specifically of the amendment to a board regulation and was not made in response to the amendments to 3.103, which is what limited the hearing officer duties to the AOJ. A limitation that, again, is fully consistent with the AMA's assignment of development responsibilities to the AOJ and not to the board. As to
the idea that it's gap filling, right? So, right. Maybe as a way to synthesize what is an uncomfortable position, right? Because I'll tell you the truth. I've been struggling with the fact that I think the regulation is pretty clear, but I actually think the explanation from the secretary in the Federal Register is pretty clear. They just go in the absolute opposite direction.
The regulation does not explicitly require the board member to engage in any type of Bryant-related questioning or development. And yes, while it is a non-exhaustive list, it does not mean that it's for, you know, claimants or the court to simply read in whatever additional requirements they want to impose on a VLJ.
And but this is one the secretary reads in.
Yeah, I was going to say something similar to that, which is that why couldn't we avoid what I think of as the untidiness of allowing an agency to say, don't worry, it looks like we're doing X, but we're not doing X, and then later saying we're doing X.
Your Honor, I agree that that language does make some implications. But again, read in context, even in the Federal Register, it was a response to a specific question concerning a duty outlined in subsection B7. And that was the context in which it was offered. And B7 was not itself intended to abrogate Bryant.
So what do we do with this, which may be a totally legally irrelevant fact? As you know, because you're in the Office of General Counsel, you folks deal with a lot of appeals. I think that's fair to say. But until I think you at the Office of General Counsel were prompted by our supplemental briefing order, I don't think the secretary has ever made this argument. And in fact, I have a case sitting on my desk that I'm sort of slow playing because it's an AMA case in which there is a Bryant issue and the secretary takes on the Bryant issue on its merits and never says anything about, well, you don't have to worry about this because it doesn't apply. So in other words, does the chief legal advisor's position following the adoption of a regulation that seems to abrogate Bryant, but the explanation that says Bryant isn't abrogated, does that have any legal bearing here?
I don't believe it does. And again, Your Honor, the commentary to the changes being made in the Part 20 section governing the duties of a presiding officer, they have to be read in the context of the entire amendments made under the AMA, which included the amendments to 3.103. And I don't see that, you know, there's no way to read those together to say that VA intended, on the face of the regulations, intended to leave Bryant in place as an obligation. Not to say that VA removed any discretion that a board member has to engage in a hearing, but only to say that it is not a regulatory requirement and that VA did change the language of 3.103. And that change in language would have absolutely no meaning if the board's regulation was read to incorporate Bryant. The limitation of the hearing officer's duties to hearings held before decisions made on a claim or supplemental claim.
Could I jump in here? Could we read the VA statement about Bryant as reflecting the thought that VA thought it was doing substantially the same thing as Bryant? And so in that sense, it wasn't abrogating Bryant at all. In fact, it was, in essence, regulating it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's fair to read the statement in it as any way as the statement did not say unequivocally that, 3.103 was applying. It did not say that the board was being bound by anything. It was commenting on the specific duties that it did impose, and it was merely commenting that those duties were not themselves an abrogation of Bryant's. And I think that's the fairest reading and the only one that's consistent with reviewing the regulatory changes as a whole.
Jake, with you had a question.
What's the Secretary's position on whether the fair process doctrine is still a permissible one, or just not for application in this case?
Your Honor, I don't believe the question needs to be fully resolved. And there would seem to be a pretty fairly strong argument as to why fair process should not exist as an independent doctrine anymore. But, Your Honor, I'm not prepared to I haven't explored every possible scenario where it can come up. I do recognize that, there are potentially, different tests that might be used, at least under this court's case law, which has set some parameters. But under due process, it's pretty clear that the Matthews test applies. It does not appear, again, that, fair process can't require more than due process or otherwise what, Congress intends within a, its intent within a statute. The Secretary, at least at this point in this argument, is not prepared to say whether it should ever exist in any context.
So can I just I'm trying to process your answer because I think I understand what you meant, which is you're saying, as I understood it, that fair process can, and I know you've gone over, but I told you could have a little bit extra, fair process can never require more than due process would require. Right? You're prepared to say that.
Yes.
But what you're saying, you're not prepared, and I don't mean not prepared like you haven't gotten ready for the argument you have, but what I mean is it's not necessary for you to then, as I understood your answer, to unpack whether in our system we would craft a due process test that wouldn't necessarily mimic Matthews versus Eldridge entirely. It might have different components or something. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yes. And to the extent to which the court could, debatable, whether the court could rely on fair process to not reach a due process question, I think that's something that can be answered and addressed at a different time.
Well, except your answer about the fact that fair process can never require more than due process wouldn't allow us to engage in constitutional avoidance. Because in order to avoid the Constitution, we'd have to first say what the Constitution meant and then say, but we won't say what it means. We'll say fair process. I don't mean to be flippant, but I mean, I can't think of a way to avoid that.
And you are correct.
You can insert the probably. I have the federal circuit.
I hadn't explored every possible scenario where fair process could come up. Again, in this particular case, fair process seems very easily addressed by the fact that any action under fair process here would, again, circumvent and contravene, Congress's deliberate removal of a procedural requirement. And I think it's resolved, pretty easily in this particular case. Your Honor, do you see that my time is...
But if the rule is not categorical, couldn't, in this case or any other particular case, the court hold that on these facts, this process was not fair?
No, Your Honor, and certainly not on these facts, because one, again, there is nothing in the record indicating that there is a relationship between the actions that were taken here and the outcome of the appellant's case, let alone that it resulted in erroneous denial of benefits. And again, there is no protection for a favorable outcome. That's not the protected interest. The veteran, the claimant, has a right to a fair and meaningful opportunity to be heard and obtained that. And as adequate safeguards, even if the board did make a mistake, there are adequate safeguards to ensure that the veteran can challenge that. In fact, in Mr. Bilharz's case itself, it's not even clear what standing he has to raise these issues in the context of the AMA, given that he specifically opted into the AMA and declined a board hearing under the AMA. So on the facts of these cases, Your Honor, no, I don't see any basis to apply fair process to find that there was a, or to find that there was an as-applied violation of fair process.
But am I correct in reading your argument as saying that you're not prepared to say that there is no set of facts under which a fair process violation could be found?
I cannot imagine any barring, but there are potentially some outrageous or absurd, set of facts, such as the one that Chief Judge Allen had raised earlier. A veterans law judge who says, absolutely, I find you credible. You were definitely going to, win on your case. Don't even bother testifying. That would probably be a violation, most likely of due process, but, fair process as well. But that's also... And that's also an issue that would exist regardless of whether the same board judge decided the appeal and conducted the hearing. And in fact, most of these issues, again, they can go either way. While the appellant asserts all of this leads to an erroneous deprivation of benefits, replacing a judge or having a second different judge, different veterans law judge decide an appeal can just as well benefit the veteran by the way that they view the law, the way that they view the record. So, Your Honors, ultimately, again, it's the role of the judiciary does not extend to imposing procedures that merely displace congressional or executive policy choices. That's what the court would be doing here by imposing a requirement that was removed by the Congress and the Secretary. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Mr. Ridgway, we'll give you your 5 minutes.
Several points, Your Honor. First, I want to begin with the most absolutely critical. And that is due process is decided in context. And the context here is that after a board hearing, the VLJ who held it is not required to make any findings, not to make any credibility determinations on the record. So this is not like the situation in MSPB where an AJ makes those findings and then they have to be given deference. This is not like the situation in Raddatz where the magistrate judge makes a list of formal findings and then the trial judge has to give them deference or hold a new hearing. If that were the context, we could treat this as a case-by-case issue. That is not the context. That is why I say we are moving the dartboard after the dart is thrown, because there is no requirement to know what the original judge was thinking. If VA wants to amend its regulations and make that a requirement, this court would be presented with a different question. That is not the system that you are being asked to compare what we argue for what they argue for.
But wouldn't the cases that you're talking about, the MSPB case and Raddatz about the magistrate judge, if the principle that you're advocating now, which is we don't know what the judge in the initial hearing was thinking, wouldn't that have just disposed of those other cases? I mean, it would be a categorical rule. It wouldn't matter about whether there was a credibility flip, right? We'd say you always have to have the same person, period.
So there's simply never been a holding on that direct question of whether it has to be the same person in a system where no findings are made at the hearing. That was not the issue in Raddatz. That's not the issue in any of these MSP cases. This is a novel issue that you must decide. The second thing I want to say is that the meaning of 20.705 was fixed in 2019. And so we know from Kaiser, the Supreme Court said, what's the best way to know what the author of a text meant when they said it? It's to see what the author said. In this case, the author spoke. The author spoke very clearly that we do not mean to abrogate Bryant. We will continue to apply Bryant and provide assistance. And so 20.705, which is on its terms a non-exhaustive list, its meaning was told to us by the secretary. And then if we go to Loper-Bright, in Loper-Bright, the Chief Justice reminded us that the meaning of a text is fixed at the time of enactment. It doesn't change later because the secretary wishes it had said something different. If the secretary wants it to say something different, there is a mechanism. It's called rulemaking. It is not called coming into this court and trying to gainsay his own voice from the time the rule was enacted. Third, I want to make sure that we understand fair process is rooted in statute. The court's authority is very clear to hold unlawful abuses of discretion. We know from Walters and Hodge and many other cases that Congress wanted this to be an informal system. The court has routinely rejected arguments that there should be specific rules of evidence, that the APA should apply. The courts have said again and again, this is an informal system. We don't want it to feel like there's too many rules. That demand for informality inherently creates discretion. Congress gave you the authority to police discretion. It's right there in 7261, and they even told you what standard to use, not your own, Congress's standard about when VA has abused its discretion, and it when it uses those gaps, that informality, to go against the desire to create a sympathetic paternalistic system where VA develops a claim to its optimum before deciding it on the merits. And I just want to close with one example from a case that I had to illustrate the difference between our positions on Bryant. A few years ago, I had a case of the court where the veteran was appealing the effective date for increase in rating. He came in, he had a hearing with the judge. All of his testimony was in the present tense. Judge said nothing. And then the judge decided that against him because your hearing testimony was not at all relevant because you were only talking about now, not the severity of your condition during the time at issue. If a hearing is only for the opportunity for a veteran who doesn't know what is relevant to blunder into giving the necessary evidence, then VA is correct. But if a hearing is part of VA's duty to sympathetically and paternalistically develop a claim to its optimum before deciding it on the merits, that judge was wrong, as VA admitted in a JMR that I can't show you, but I believe you would understand that is a clear violation of Bryant. The judge has to bring out the information that is relevant and material. And with that, I ask you to remand Mr. Bilharz's case for a new decision by the same judge and for Mr. Pinto to have an opportunity for a new hearing and decision by that same judge. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ridgway. And I neglected to say this at the beginning, but I want to do it now. I want to thank your firm, Berkman & Moore, for agreeing to participate as amicus curiae on behalf of Mr. Pinto, who is pro se and acting without representation. And so the court thanks you for that. Before I submit the case formally, I just want to say that for those of you watching online, the four or five of you around the United States, you won't get to see this next part, but we are going to, as is the tradition of our court, which we've adopted from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Jaquith and I are going to come down and greet counsel, and then we're going to stay and we're going to answer questions from the folks in the audience. So that's what's going to happen now. And with that, the case just argued is submitted.